I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for February 19th, 2010. We are going to take the bills, at least at first, in the order that they have been presented, and I'm going to go open a hearing on 3657A. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview? Representative, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3657A prohibits the owner of a foreclosed residential property from neglecting upkeep on the property during periods when the property is vacant, exempts local governments that are owners of the foreclosed properties, permits local governments to assess a civil penalty of up to $150 for each day for which the owner fails to remedy the conditions, sunsets the provisions on January 2, 2014. This measure comes to you from the House floor on a 35-23-2 vote. There is no revenue or fiscal impact on the measure.
Representative, could you please identify yourself for the record and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. I am, for the record, my name is Lou Frederick and I represent District 43 in North and Northeast Portland. Good to see you. I'd like to speak a bit about House Bill 3657. We call it the Good Neighbors Bill, and Portland's experience with foreclosed homes and blighted neighborhoods. This is, frankly, a real problem in Portland, especially the Northeast Portland district that I represent. It has been a problem for years, and one that has only been made worse by the current housing crisis. Neglected properties foster increased crime, squatting, vandalism, and drug use. They set back the hard work we are undertaking to restore pride in our communities. These problems also carry significant financial consequences. One foreclosure can impose up to $34,000 in direct costs on local government agencies, including inspections, court actions, police and fire department efforts, potential demolition, unpaid water and sewage, and trash removal. Foreclosed properties also drag down the property values of other homes in their neighborhood. Between 2009 and 2012, homeowners in Oregon will lose an estimated $9.2 million in home equity due to the blight of neglected properties in their neighborhood. This means an average loss in home equity of $8,442 per homeowner. I've seen this problem manifested in Northeast Portland and in Burns. In my district, within a 16-block area, I once counted 101 empty, abandoned, or foreclosed homes. In Burns, after a series of mill closures, and when I was a reporter, I saw a street of 10 homes with only one family still in the residence. We have given local governments and banks time to remedy this problem on their own with mixed results. Now it is time for us as a body to help the residents of our communities, protect our neighborhoods, and prevent further costs resulting from this crisis. House Bill 3657 gives localities an additional tool, an optional tool, to help us solve these challenges. It allows local governments to require banks and other owners of foreclosed properties to perform upkeep, or to get a chance to do a number of other things that would make sure that the community feels that it's doing well. Oregon needs this bill. The League of Oregon Cities and I ask for your support in sending House Bill 3657 to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Frederick? Senator Metzger, then Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. Just help me clarify something I'm still confused about. Is there are local ordinances that some municipalities have on similar. So it doesn't appear that there's a prohibition to that. So help me think of giving them permission to do something that they apparently have permission to do already. I'm just trying to figure out why we need this bill since they appear to have that authority.
Well, you're absolutely correct, Chair Devlin and Senator Metzger. You're absolutely correct. A number of local municipalities have this have the ability to do some things in terms of nuisance, but some do not. What we are seeing in a number of counties are in unincorporated areas. We're seeing foreclosures not just in the cities. We're seeing foreclosures in unincorporated areas that do not have these kinds of nuisance capabilities. And this gives them, and those cities and counties that do have it, this gives them an additional option. They don't have to use it, but it gives them an additional tool, and that's what this is all about.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you very much.
Hello there.
Nice to meet you.
We've met before, but good to see you
again. I know, but not in the committee.
This is true.
Thank you very much. Tell me, give me some elaboration on why local governments are exempted.
Local governments are exempted from being, they would not be suing themselves. That's what the exemption is about. It's not an exempted. If they have a problem, they would not be suing themselves or having to charge fees to themselves to get things repaired and cleaned up. That's what the exemption is about. It's not about anything else.
Well, the reason I ask is oftentimes municipalities who own land are some of the last to clean them up, in my experience.
Well,
and so if we're going to exempt them, and we're going to do this to the private guys, what assurances do we have that local government's going to clean up that abandoned field or whatnot?
Chair Devlin, and I'm still getting the protocol here on
this. You're doing fine.
Chair Devlin and Senator Atkinson, what the people who have come forward regarding this particular bill have been primarily concerned about private foreclosed properties. The concern has not been in terms of the cities, and that's the approach that's been taken, and the idea that the cities and the counties already are supposed to be doing this. The idea that they would be charging themselves didn't seem to make a lot of sense. And the League of Oregon Cities also agreed on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional questions at this time? Seeing none. Senator Farioli.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson asked the question that had been interesting to me. I guess I am seeing situations where with the bank failures, sometimes it's not very clear who the owner is, and with the protracted procedures, it's likely these houses do get pretty run down, and occasionally the counties end up in the ownership because of tax defaults, and cities also. And perhaps it would also be an effective remedy for a neighbor at least to be able to compel the city to clean up a property, or for an affected neighbor in an unincorporated area to compel the county to take action under existing nuisance ordinances. And right now, they really don't have a mechanism to compel local government to do the cleanup they ought to do. So, you know, but that's not the focus of this bill. I just wondered if it had ever occurred to you that maybe the recalcitrant party happens to be a governmental agency.
Well, again, Chair Devlin and Senator Farioli, good to see you. I haven't seen you in quite a while, actually. The focus of this bill was a relatively narrow one, and the concerns that were being expressed were primarily dealing with private folks, not so much municipalities that owned as a result of tax issues. And so this was a relatively narrow focus, and the idea was to, again, give a tool for the municipalities, the counties, whatever group, to be able to handle these particular situations. Because, as I said, I have watched neighborhoods really deteriorate, not because of things that they were doing, but because things had been left to fall apart, and somebody wanted to get something else done there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Atkinson had a follow-up.
So yes.
Thank you very much. Representative, I really appreciate where this is coming from. A question and a comment. First, the question. In the House deliberations on this bill, was it ever discussed limiting this to, say, five counties or starting small before it was a statewide bill?
Chair Devlin, Senator Atkinson, you know, I did not participate in the conversation initially about that. As I understand it, no. In another bill that was being considered that was regarding, I'm trying to remember what it was. Oh, it was regarding the trailers. Trailer homes and such. They did limit it to certain counties. That was not what was brought up, as far as I know.
Thank you. Just by way of reference, I know some bills like this that have a narrow fit in one part of Oregon Some of the things we've done, in fact, this committee, and I can think of supporters and the entire, all these members, some things we've limited down to like a watershed or a river basin or something just to get it started before it was taken, to make sure it worked before it was taken statewide. And I'm wondering if this wouldn't solve the problem in the geographic area that you're concerned and also provide the let's see if it works type of angle to the rest of Oregon.
Chair Devlin, Senator Atkinson, one of the things that became very clear was that this was not a narrowly geographic area focused situation. There were folks in Bend, there were folks in eastern, far eastern Oregon, and in southern Oregon that were concerned about this, both in rural and urban and suburban areas. So this, again, was an attempt to try to deal with, to give statewide a tool to deal with these particular properties. It was not, say, a Portland or a suburban area that was were causing problems. You were talking about foreclosed properties. Because of our crisis, the foreclosed properties across the line, all across the state.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Any additional? Seeing none, thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
I've asked the League of Oregon Cities to submit a letter. I know that they're supportive, and they will submit the letter to the committee as soon as possible. With that, I'm going to close that public hearing. I'm going to go to the foot of the calendar and open a public hearing on SB 1064. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview, and could Senator Prosansky come forward, and Mr. Skerritt also, actually.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1064 removes the ability for all felons to petition a court to be allowed to purchase and possess firearms, allows felons who have been released from prison for more than 15 years with only one felony to petition a court to purchase and possess a firearm if the conviction did not involve a firearm or a switchblade knife or a criminal homicide, allows petitions only in circuit court to declare an emergency as effective upon passage. There's a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the original measure.
Senator Prosansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Floyd Prosansky, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. What you have before you, Senate Bill 1064, is a narrow version of Senate Bill 1008 that we actually processed through the Judiciary Committee. It focuses, as your committee administrator said, on the specifics as to a felon, as to when they would be able to petition the court for the actual possession of a firearm. It does have limitations, and I can just give a very short history. Mr. Sirlik came to me last session during 09, talked about an anomaly that was already occurring where a person could, in fact, receive the right to purchase a firearm, but they were not able to actually possess that firearm. Based on that information, I felt it was appropriate that we clarify that a person that could actually, at the time, be able to purchase would be able to actually possess. And the intent of the legislation that was coming forward under Senate Bill 603 during the 2009 session was, in fact, to include that that process that would allow that a person after 15 years where they would automatically be able to purchase a weapon, they would, in fact, be able to possess that weapon so long as the felon was only convicted of one felony, and that felony was not for a criminal homicide or involved a weapons offense. And so that is what we have before us now. As I will mention, just to put on the record, Senate Bill 1008 that came out of our committee had numerous components to it. We were going to use that bill because of the relating clause relating to crime as a vehicle for multiple other issues that were coming forward during this interim that different agencies and groups wanted us to take care of. We've decided that those areas and those issues, even though they may be important in time for those various groups, that they were not important enough to put into this particular bill, and this is basically the narrowed version to deal just only with felons to be able to, when they would be able to petition a court to get their right to possess. Currently, we have a law that went into effect at the end of last session that basically now allows for any felon, no matter what their felony conviction or multiple convictions are for, to be able to petition a court. It's my position as the chair of that committee, as well as a gun owner for the last 40 years, that I believe, and the majority of people who were I've spoken with, that we should have some type of timeout and requirement for those individuals to wait before they can actually petition the court. And this is a means to do that, to fall in line with what is already automatically allowed for individuals who have had that wait of 15 years, again, with only one conviction that was not a criminal homicide or petition to purchase a gun. Now, I want to also just share with the committee that when we had this bill up and for hearing during this session, we had another bill, 1007. One of the gentlemen who was here on the Senate Bill 1008 was there for the in attendance during the testimony on 1007. His name is Vern Wigley. Mr. Wigley lives in Dundee. He sent me an email afterwards talking about being Special Forces, U.S. Army, Green Beret, and that he was taken back by hearing the testimony of some of the victims or families of victims under 1007 as to what they had to go through. And as he states in his email, which copies have been provided to the committee, he basically says that neither I nor NRA or OFF advocate giving this type of felon any access to a firearm, period. And I can say confidently that I would not associate myself with any organization and that would be okay with that type of behavior. So we do have other individuals who have spoken out and have decided that they wanted their voice to be heard. I can tell you also that I had this afternoon forwarded to my office from another member from the House side an email that he received from an attorney who said that he is already using Senate Bill 603 to allow felons to get their guns rights back. I can't tell you how many of his clients he's referring to or what their actual crimes are. Well, I can tell you that if we don't fix the unintended consequence that occurred from the drafting error on Senate Bill 603, we can, in fact, expect that other individuals who have very serious felonies being able to petition a court, in fact, justice courts, to attempt to get their gun rights back. Lastly, I would tell you that we in the state have taken a position, even for a convicted individual, for them to actually expunge their record. There is at least a minimum of 3-day, 3-year wait period for them to have to go through and stay free of crime before they can even attempt to expunge their record through a court. It only seems fair and reasonable, and as I said, what the intent with 603 was to allow those individuals who had met the minimum time of 15 years to actually be able to petition the court for the right to possess, where they would have the right to purchase. Lastly, the Oregon Gun Owners Association, represented by Paul Phillips, he and I have spoken about this bill, Senate Bill 1064, and he is in full support, and his organization is also supporting it, so long as it's not amended.
Okay. We'll go to questions after Mr. Skerritt. Mr. Skerritt.
Members of the committee.
I'm sorry for mispronouncing your name. I'm a rules chair. I usually do mispronounce names. So.
For the record, my name is Kevin Starrett, and I represent the Oregon Firearms Federation. This bill, 1064, is a bill that almost no one's had a chance to study, which replaces a bill that no one understood, which reversed a bill that everybody voted for. There was not a single no vote. In fact, your chamber voted for it twice. And what this bill does is make a major reversal of policy of a law that's been in effect for less than 2 months, which we've had no indication is causing a problem. I know of one person who's petitioned to have his rights restored, and he was denied. I'm familiar with the attorney that Senator Prezansky referred to, because I got a copy of an email that I believe went to you, Senator Devlin, and said that he was attempting to use the law to get rights restorations for his clients. I know who some of his clients are. They are not the kind of people that I think the person, the Green Beret that Senator Prezansky mentioned, is concerned about. The problem is that this bill has been, I mean, the original bill, 603, was an attempt to correct the problem that everybody agreed existed. The law said you can petition the courts to buy a gun, but you can't own it. The problem that we've had through this entire process is there's been so much confusion about several anomalies in Oregon law that now they're all masked together. Senate Bill 1064 replaces Senate Bill 1008, which was 43 pages long, I'm not really sure how we crammed the 43 pages into the piece, this piece of legislation. I do know that in a process where, in order for me to be here to even address this bill, I had to break quite a few speed limits. And I think what's happening is we're rushing through something without having determined if there's actually a problem. What the law says now is that a person can ask to have his rights restored. There's nothing automatic about it. But one of the issues that I think is important is that we have over and over confused two completely separate things. One is the right to petition, to ask the courts to be able to demonstrate that you are a decent person, in spite of having had a felony conviction. The other issue is this 15-year business that's currently in Oregon law, and has been forever, and had nothing to do with petitioning for rights. It had no bearing on petitioning for rights whatsoever. What it said was that after 15 years, if you weren't if you hadn't committed a homicide, and your charge was not a weapons charge, some of your rights were automatically restored. It never said you had to petition for them. It was an automatic restoration of rights. And now what we have is a bill that's reversing something you all agreed was a good idea before we have any indication that it's a problem. And in addition to which, what we have, there's another factor here that I don't really think has been discussed much. Of course, this bill hasn't been discussed much at all. But one of the things that you can't have a firearms conviction and petition to have your rights restored. But we all tend to think of firearms convictions as things like somebody who used a gun in a crime. But many firearms convictions, the people who I hear from who've had firearms convictions, have done something like bought a gun from their brother. That's a felony if your brother happens to live in another state. And I will tell you, gentlemen, that there are felons amongst you within this very body who have done things like that, that are entirely innocent transfers because people are unaware of the fact that, oh, I gave my daughter a gun. Oops, my daughter lives in Vancouver. Now we're both felons. Those people who've hurt no one, who are not dangerous, who are peaceful people, who didn't even know they were doing something wrong, would be denied the right to petition forever under this legislation. These aren't people who held up a grocery store. These are people who made a technical error of a law they didn't know existed. And finally, in Senate Bill 1008, there was one thing in it that I think was correct. That is where we fixed the mistake that was made in 603. We're currently in Oregon. There's no lawful way to travel on a motorcycle with a firearm if it's a handgun. Senate Bill 1008 actually fixed that. Senate Bill 1064 completely removes that, putting us right back where we were with the one mistake that existed in 603. And I would also like to put on the record, I spoke recently, moments ago, to the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association, who can't be here right now, and he wanted me to share with you that it is their position that this is not the correct time or place to ram through a confusing piece of legislation to correct something that may not even be a problem, especially since what you're changing is a bill that every one of you agreed to in 2009.
Mr. Phillips, will you come forward also? Questions for the first? Well, I'll go to Mr. Phillips next, and then we'll go to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips, PacWest Communication, representing the Oregon gun owners. It's interesting, both previous speakers are correct. That doesn't solve your problem. I can see Kevin's position where he's concerned that you're rushing something through. I see Floyd's position where we're looking at what is a narrowly crafted bill. I'd encourage you to read the bill. We did. I counseled with my clients and said, we're talking about post-prison supervision. We're talking about preparing for actions. The fact that a bill passed unanimously, it was a good bill last session, doesn't mean that if there are some problems in interpretation or potential things that we shouldn't take preemptive action and address that. I think the narrow crafting of the bill leads my clients to believe that this would be a good preemptive action. I would also agree that it does need plenty of airing. I'm sorry that Rod from the NRA is not here and having a chance to testify, but that's what happens when you have one-hour notices of processes. But so that's our position, Mr. Chair.
And again, your clients, for the record?
The Oregon gun owners.
Okay. Questions for the parties? Seeing none, thank you very much. Just by way of the record, I can recall actually one instance in which a bill went through the both chambers, had more than a dozen lobbyists involved in it, several state agencies, numerous drafters, and for an allocation for a program left out the words per annum. And we had to come in the next session and correct it. Actually, probably Senator Metzger remembers that bill.
I do.
That, I will close that public hearing. And we will go on to House Bill 3700. I believe I probably have a pretty good sign-up sheet for this. For the sake of the record, just so the people here understand, the Rules Committee is under one-hour notice. We're holding public hearings on bills now. Some of the bills are just public hearings for today. But when we come back into session, if we go into work session on a bill, that might last as little as 30 or 40 seconds. That's the way the Rules Committee normally operates at this juncture in the session. So please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3700. We provided you with a testimony packet, and I have met with all of you individually to talk about the bill, so I'm not going to go over kind of the generic part of the bill. I have two great people here to testify. I gave you a little bit of background on what public deposits are, the history and what we did in the 2003 legislative session. Some of the arguments coming up related to the credit union structure on the tax issue, I provided that in my testimony, and I really just don't need to go over that with all of you. I think you're all very aware. So I'm going to turn it over to Hal Scoggins, our attorney, and he's going to go briefly over some of the context of the bill.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley, Wada, Witt in Portland. We are the outside attorneys for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We also represent many credit unions throughout Oregon, Washington, and the Western United States. This issue of credit unions being able to accept public funds deposits has been in the works for many, many, many years. We had a bill up last session which would have done essentially the same thing, but it was pulled in order to allow the treasurer and the banks that were currently participating the opportunity to make changes to the public funds collateralization process and get that done before we came in with this process. So this session we have a bill which will allow credit unions to participate in the public funds process in exactly the same, a parallel manner to what is available to banks. This bill will essentially create a collateral pool that's parallel to that of banks, but it includes a number of features that are designed to make sure that as the program starts up, the public and the credit unions are appropriately protected and the program can be appropriately managed. The first of those is simply related to funding, and that's to say that the Treasurer does not have to do anything to start up a program of allowing credit unions to accept public funds deposits over $250,000 until there are adequate funds in the Treasury to operate the program for the first fiscal period. And those funds come from the credit unions that participate, just like the funds to administer the bank program come from the banks themselves. So the credit unions will have to come up with the funds necessary to operate the program before it ever starts. The second thing is that there have to be at least five credit unions ready to participate, and those five credit unions each have to have a letter from a public funds manager that says they want to deposit funds with that credit union in excess of the $250,000 limit. Then the third thing that it does is to say, while there are less than 10 credit unions participating in the program, the state treasurer can increase the maximum liability of each credit union under what I call the cross-collateral provision, and that's liability of one credit union for deposits that are in another credit union if that other credit union fails. The treasurer can increase that liability from 10% to 20% of the surviving credit union's deposits. public funds deposits, that is, while there are less than 10 credit unions participating in the program. And the idea for that is simply to provide additional protection to the public funds that are placed with credit unions while there are fewer than 10 participants in the program. Then finally, the treasurer can suspend the program if at any time there's a six-month period where there are less than five credit unions participating. This simply recognizes that if there are less than five credit unions participating, the treasurer might not feel that it's worthwhile to administer the program, and so the treasurer can pull the plug at that point if necessary. That's the basic rules for how this program would get started, and then once it's started, it would operate in exactly the same way that the collateralization program currently functions for banks. I just want to take a minute to address the issue of the complexity. And there's been discussion back and forth about whether the program's too complex for credit unions and whether it can be applied in the same manner to credit unions as it can to banks. The answer to that is legally there's no reason why it can't be applied in the same manner to credit unions as it is to banks. It is a good program and it's an effective program. It balances carefully the safety and soundness of the institutions with the need to protect public funds, and there's been no reason advanced by anybody over the many years that we've been discussing this that you can't apply the same program to credit unions as you do to banks. I'll end my testimony there and be happy to answer questions.
Okay, we'll go to the final party and then take questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to give testimony this afternoon. My name is Richard Hine. I'm the president and CEO of OSU Federal Credit Union in Corvallis, Oregon. We are a federally based, federally chartered community credit union that serve in five counties, which include Benton, Lincoln, Polk, and Marion counties. We've been doing that for the past 15 years. One of the things that I want to ensure that the committee knows that we in the local community of Corvallis have always had great relationships with our local community bankers. One of the things that happened in 2008-2009, OSU Federal Credit Union was selected as the National Community Credit Union of the Year by the Credit Union National Association. In doing so, we received a recommendation from our local community bank recommending us for that designation. It was because of our outstanding reputation, focus on member service, and commitment to the credit union mission was the reason why we were selected. We're very, very active in our communities, especially providing financial education, which is in critical need at this time in our communities. Because of our reputation, we often have our members who are part of the public entities ask us if we're available to deposit public funds. And as we know, because of the limit of $250,000, we can accept public funds, but only up to that amount. Unfortunately, in our area, they feel that that's too cumbersome for them for them to administer that on a regular basis. Also, we're finding out that there is a huge movement in our local communities to buy local, as we all know. Recently, Rivermark Credit Union received a call from the city of Beaverton asking if they would be available. They were receiving about $50 million, and they wanted to divide that amongst local entities. And, of course, Rivermark Credit Union had to decline any type of public deposits other than $250,000. We hear that zero game will not increase the total liquidity or lending in Oregon. What we have provided you in my testimony is an outline of just a small snippet of a survey that we quickly did in the five counties in which we live and service. Of 15 public entities, 10 of which we found out that their primary financial institution was a large national bank, out-of-state national bank, two of which were larger regional banks headquartered in Oregon, one was out-of-state regional bank headquartered in Washington, and only two in our five-county area actually used a local community bank. Statewide, one of the things that we did is went to the FDIC website, and Oregon-based banks held approximately $1.72 billion
in public funds as of December 31st, 2009. Of these funds, $1.46 billion, or 85%, are housed at the largest five banks in Oregon: Umpqua, West Coast, Bank of Cascades, Premier, and Columbia River, which, of course, as we all know, is now housed in a Washington bank, Washington-based bank. Nationally, recently, the Huffington Post reported that public municipalities had about $230 billion socked away in 85 national banks with assets over $10 billion, according to FDIC. There were just one-third that amount, around $78 billion, in 6,386 bank institutions under a billion. So as we look at that, in the state of Oregon, only $260 million are actually in local community banks. What we're saying here is the largest share of our public fund dollars actually go to large national banks outside the state of Oregon. And with us as an opportunity, we could bring a few more of those dollars back and invest in the local economies and everything. So I urge you to consider HB 3700. It's good for Oregon, and it's really good for Oregonians, too.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yes.
I didn't address the amendments. I just want to get on the record that we reviewed the dash A4s, A5, and A6. We certainly would prefer and are willing to negotiate and support the dash A4s, which moves implementation back to 2012.
Questions? Yes, Senator Metzger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the amendment, and colleagues, our Business and Transportation Committee heard this yesterday morning and, again, yesterday afternoon, which led to the development of the A4 amendment, because a lot of the concern was the immediacy of different opinions of whether that was pertinent or not, but that was the concern that folks had, that that if money were to migrate out in the immediate future, that that could present an issue. And so that was the development of the A4, which is a two-year delay before the program could be initiated, and then also a year after the next legislative session. So I just asked Pam, I mean, if that's a characterization, a correct characterization of the concerns that our committee had, it wasn't so much on the policy, but in terms of when this might take place. Is that...
Chair Devlin and Senator Metzger, thank you very much for that explanation. You did a much better job than I did. But absolutely, yes. I think that one of the concerns that was brought up is the immediate impact on, you know, community banks. I think there are some disagreeing opinions on how that would work. But I think that our willingness to push out implementation shows that we're willing to negotiate on this bill, and we're willing to move that back and work with the Treasurer's Office. I know someone is here from the Treasurer's Office that they might have some opinions on implementation date also.
Okay. That's all I have.
Senator Atkinson?
Thank you. Quite a few questions, Mr. Chair, but I'll probably be asking other panels. 1934, United States Congress passed the Federal Credit Union Act that gave you dual licensure, both state and federal, correct? Is that right? Do I have my history right? I think I do.
Right, 1934.
In fact, I think I've got it pretty better than most of the professional folks in this room think I do. But you just started then the whole debate between if it's a bank, it should be taxed, if it's a credit union, it should not be taxed. And that's the debate. That's really the fundamental underlying issue of why there's so many people upset about this bill. And for everybody that nods yes in the front, there's 10 people in the back that nod no, and I'm sure that'll switch as soon as we change panels. Given that tax-exempt status, when you receive these loans, if you were to receive these deposits into your institution, how will you use your tax-exempt status to pass on the savings or the leverage to your members?
Chair Devlin, Senator Atkinson, that's a great question. credit unions have inevitably, and one of the things to keep in mind, the reason credit unions aren't taxed is one is because we are formed under a not-for-profit financial cooperative, as it states in the tax code, the United States tax code, and under that, we pass back all of our earnings back to our membership in the way of better rates. For loans, higher rates on dividends, and lower fees and better services.
Are you a commercial? Is credit unions expanding into the commercial world of banking?
Commercially. Senator Devlin, Chairman Atkinson, credit unions are making member business loans. And the reason we are is because many of our members who use us as individuals actually now are starting businesses and finding, and we're seeing a great deal of that, and I can provide the committee with some additional information, are finding that when they're going to other financial institutions, they're not being taken seriously. And
what do you mean by that?
They probably don't meet their underwriting guidelines or their qualifications for lending. So it could be a good example is a restaurant in Corvallis, Block 15. There's a young couple that had a lot of restaurant experience and brewery experience, and they decided that they wanted to start their own brewery and restaurant, and went around to a number of other financial institutions, and nobody would take them seriously. And they came to us, and we listened to them and helped them through an SBA loan. And now they employ over 50 people in Corvallis and are doing a really good job.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yes.
Ms. Levitt, can you tell me if any members of your association have, in the last year, pulled back their lines of credit for members?
Chair Devlin, Senator Atkinson, we talked a little bit about that question, and I did an email, and I have not heard of any of our members pulling back lines of credit. I don't know if Hal, as our attorney, has any more specific examples that you can...
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I every financial institution in the state, as well as all the institutions out of the state, have had to look carefully at credit over the past year. And whether that is in terms of unsecured visas, or I'm not sure precisely what your question was directed at. Business lines of credit. In my experience, and we represent many of the credit unions in the state, I don't think there's been a wholesale pulling back. At any given point in time, any business is looked at. It has an ongoing relationship with its lender, and if there's an issue with a particular business, it's certainly possible that business...
Just for the record, when we talk about the FDIC, which does not apply to you, what is the federal deposit insurance body for credit unions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, it is the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund, which is operated by the National Credit Union Administration.
Has that fund snapped any of your members to behave differently in Oregon? And then last, in the economic downturn?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I'm unclear what you might mean by has it snapped them to
FDIC. Is several of the banks that you listed in your testimony has snapped, and all of a sudden people have got people under cease and desist orders, and local community businesses cannot get access to capital. They can't get it. Is that happening in the credit unions in Oregon?
What I would say, Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, is that every institution's lending policies are scrutinized every time they're examined, and you know they're taken into account. If the regulator feels that practices need to be tightened up, they'll certainly make that clear. And so I wouldn't want to represent that hasn't ever taken place in the state of Oregon. I can tell you that credit unions are trying to make every single loan that they possibly can. My unscientific impression is that credit unions have not had the same degree of pulling back that there may have been in the banking sector, and that may be because credit unions
that's what I'm last question, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Why is that?
I could speculate on that, Mr. Chair, and
speculate away,
Atkinson. I one answer might be that I think the way that credit unions do lending, and this is my impression, is different from the way that banks do lending. And sometimes credit unions make loans that banks wouldn't make, as Mr. Hine just testified, and it's not because banks are bad or they're trying to be, you know, trying to withhold money from people. It's just because they have a different relationship with their customers than credit unions do with their members. Credit unions historically make loans that banks wouldn't make, but historically credit unions' delinquency and charge-off ratios have been lower. I can tell you that I worked for a bank before I went to law school. We were right next to a credit union. I was on a military base. Anytime I turned down a loan, I told the applicant to go over to the credit union because 9 times out of 10 they would make the loan that we wouldn't make. Again, that's unscientific. That's only my own personal experience, but I think a part of that is simply because credit unions have a relationship with the member that's different, and because of that, they're able to do some things that banks can't.
Okay. Any additional questions? Senator Metzger.
Just to comment on a couple of things that Senator Atkinson was asking for the panelists here. Mr. Scoggins, this is an obvious answer, but regarding the taxation issue, if you're paying more in dividends, they go to the members. And do they then not, at that point, pay taxes on when they file their income taxes on the interest or dividends that they earned?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's exactly right. Everything that's paid out to members in the form of dividends is taxed just like any other dividend or interest income that they receive. There's no question about that.
And just an observation on some of the comments that you made, and good question, Senator Atkinson, is that this is my own personal experience, and it's been a number of years since I've been a credit union director. But I was vice chair of what is the largest credit union in Oregon. And one thing that we experienced then, and I don't think this is too different now, is that, that what is maybe not totally unique to credit unions, because community banks have the same, in many cases, provide the same service, but that, as opposed to the national banks, but almost all of your customers, you know them very well because they're not, because they are in your community. And so the ability to work with them and know them is much closer. And so in terms of the lending decisions, whereas it might be some officer in Louisiana or Birmingham, Alabama, you have a little better idea of what you're lending. I think you also find, because of the magnitude of the lending on the commercial side especially, you know, a lot of the larger banks deal in a lot larger loans, of which many people, as probably the one that you suggested in Corvallis, you know, they're not looking for that kind of capital, and yet there's a lot of institutions who wouldn't be interested in going the paperwork for something, you know, necessarily that small that can provide it. I know he's not here now, but in Senator Ferrioli's district, Oregon Trail Credit Union, the services, as I remember the statistics from 2 years ago, so it's not current, Senator, but well over 70% of their, quote, business loans were to farmers to buy a piece of equipment that simply they did not have access to at that level. So I think that's, you know, and maybe some of the differences and why I think some of the lending practices you may find are still stronger, say, in the credit unions than, say, the national banks, although I would say the community banks would be able to make that same argument as well. That's my observation.
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, I just want to put on the record that we have a cap on what we call member business lending for credit unions. It's 12.25% of assets. There are some credit unions grandfathered because the law was passed in 1998. It was part of our field of membership legislation at the federal level, and that cap was put in place. If you were doing a lot of ag and business lending prior to that, you were grandfathered in, which is Old West Credit Union. John Day was part of that. But we do have that current cap. We certainly would like to lift it for situations where credit unions have the opportunity to provide more. We don't call them commercial loans, we call them member business loans.
Thank you. Any additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much. I will next call up Mr. Ray Davis and Ms. Linda Navarro. please start in whichever order you choose to.
Okay. I'll go ahead. Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Navarro. I'm president and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I'm here today primarily on behalf of the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, which are the state charter banks headquartered in this state. We represent depository institutions and savings banks, including mutual savings banks, which are structured quite similar to a credit union, and they all have deep roots in their communities and really are focused on demonstrating a commitment to supporting, growing, developing, sustaining the communities that they serve. The issue today before you is a serious consequence to these banks. The idea that this bill is somehow more impactful to large banks is not true, because the largest banks in this state do hold public funds, but those relationships are pretty sophisticated, and it's highly unlikely that the local governments that are banking with the largest banks are going to be the ones looking to move their deposits into credit unions. It's the local governments that have relationships with community banks that would look favorably upon other local institutions. So it will be the local banks that are most impacted. You also heard in prior testimony a figure that I did not believe is accurate about the number of public funds in local community banks. This week I verified with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and there is in fact $1.9 billion of public deposits in Oregon's community banks. I'm not sure what the source of that other number was, but if you look at the Treasurer's report, that only shows collateralized public funds. And right now there are many tools in place that provide for insured public deposits to be above the normal $250,000 limit. So therefore, in the case of Citizens Bank, for example, the Treasurer's report shows them having $750,000 in public funds. They actually have $5.5 million in public funds. So $1.9 billion, and we've estimated through two independent sources that the average amount of state taxes generated by $100 million in a bank is $316,000. So the impact of $1.9 billion of public deposits in community banks could theoretically be translated into about $6 million of income tax to the state. A couple of points, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Davis. I do want to say that Lark Weisham has testified both in the House Rules Committee as well as in the Senate Business Committee. She's CFO of Citizens Bank, and she offers a very good perspective on the impact on smaller Oregon community banks. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to be here today with the notice we were able to provide her, so we did give you a written copy of her testimony, and I would encourage you to read it, because another major point about community banks is in this state, the vast majority of community banks maintain a 100% loan-to-deposit ratio, which means for every dollar of deposits in that bank, they lend out those dollars in their community. So for every dollar that leaves a community bank, that's one less dollar that that community bank can make in loans. And make no mistake, it is the community banks that are focused on small business banking in this state. That's their niche. It's not the niche of credit unions, or at least it shouldn't be. Their mission is not commercial banking. Some may want it to be commercial banking, but that's not the reason they were given their tax-exempt status. So it's important to small businesses in this state that community banks continue to thrive, work through the challenges of the current environment, and be here for us for years to come. Clackamas County Bank was founded in Oregon in 1911, still operates as Clackamas County Bank today. I can't stress enough the importance historically and into the future of community bankings in this state, community banks in this state, and frankly, with times being what they are and with real estate values being what they are and accounting rules being what they are, it's putting a lot of stress on those banks. And adding
that stress by shifting deposits of public entities, a commercial banking activity, essentially, from tax-paying community banks to government-subsidized credit unions isn't fair and doesn't make sense to the community bank. It's not about whether you like credit unions or whether there are credit unions in this state that are doing a great job or adhering to their purpose. There are. But it's about whether it's good public policy to extend commercial banking, including public banking, to credit unions, which were given their tax-exempt status for the specific purpose of serving people with limited means, not commercial banking, not public entities. I won't belabor the points about credit unions and how, you know, from our point of view, they've morphed to two distinct entities. I basically kind of touched on that, but I would like to make a point about the mutual savings banks, because this is not well understood. First Federal Savings and Loan in McMinnville, Evergreen Federal Savings Bank of Grants Pass. These are mutually owned savings banks. They had tax-exempt status until the 1950s. They don't anymore. And I would challenge anyone to tell me how an institution like On Point, the former Portland Teachers Credit Union, which has $2.7 billion in assets, it's larger than all but two of the one state chartered bank in the state of Oregon, is any different other than larger than these mutual savings banks, except they have a tax advantage. And with that tax advantage, there should be a difference in the kinds of powers that are extended to those institutions. I mentioned the tax impact of $6 million. I will also just make a note that I didn't have planned, but that is, I heard some questions about the health of credit unions, and there are, as of today, I think 357 credit unions nationally on the troubled credit union list. We're all impacted, is my point, by this challenging environment. So I don't think it's really possible, unless you have the proprietary information that regulators have, to draw a conclusion about which credit unions and frankly, which banks are under the most stress. All you can look at is the public numbers, and every bank certainly has its numbers disclosed quarterly in its call reports. In closing, I'm a little stunned by the pace of the session. I'm sure you are, too. This is a major, major public policy issue to us of extreme consequence to community banks. And I would ask you to strongly consider giving this issue, which is not new, which is being vetted in other states and has been vetted in Oregon as recently as 2009, the chance to be discussed, considered, and evaluated in terms of its consequences on our members in a more deliberative process. And no disrespect to the process, this session, or certainly to the wisdom of this committee, but frankly, it's a way too important of an issue to us to understand how it could be moved quickly this session. Why now, when it wasn't even moved in 2009? So with that, I'll thank you for the opportunity to address the committee and offer to answer any questions either now or after Mr. Davis testifies.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to questions after both panelists testify. Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Senator Devlin, Chair Devlin, and Senators. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. I'll make my comments fairly brief. First, I'd like to give you just a little bit of a background on Umpqua Bank.
Thanks.
Umpqua Bank is considered to most of the people throughout the state as Oregon's bank. It's founded in 1953 in Canyonville, Oregon, small town. We are now located throughout the state of Oregon, Washington, and Northern California. And what was once a small, sleepy community bank is now one of the country's strongest and largest community banks, with $10 billion in collective assets and 162 store locations throughout our footprint. Very important to us is the Oregon heritage, the rich Oregon heritage that we have developed over these last 50-some-odd years, and we will never forsake the communities that have supported us over the years. We are also very proud to say that we're headquartered in Oregon, one of the very few publicly traded companies that still remains in the state of Oregon with their headquarters. And as I said, we're very proud to call this beautiful state our home. As Oregon's largest community bank, a few additional facts I'd like to point out regarding Umpqua. We have been very active within the state stimulus programs. We have worked closely with the governor's office on sustainability programs, trying again to create opportunities for people in the state. Last year, we created jobs here in Oregon as we grew our company. Even today, we are trying to fill over 100 new jobs in our company. Due to the size of the bank and the store footprint, and this is important, we import into Oregon over $50 million a day from our franchise. Recently, a lot of talk has been centered on banks failing to lend in their communities. And this is certainly true in instances where the community bank or large banks are stressed. As Senator Atkinson pointed out, banks that are under cease and desist orders, they have to operate differently, just as credit unions, who are also very stressed, have to change their operations. However, it's not true of all of the institutions. Umpqua Bank last year loaned out total new loan production $1.7 billion. That's with a B. Over $1 billion of that was originated here in the state of Oregon. We are lending money out in the state of Oregon, and I can say for the vast majority of the community banks are doing their very level best to also loan that money out. We heard some testimony here this afternoon from the credit unions talking about the restaurant or different people that applied and were turned down, and the only place you could get a loan would be in the credit union. What they don't talk about are all the applications that are approved. All of the applications that are approved. I think it's fair to say, and I think you will agree with me on this, that this state needs jobs. And small business are the largest creator of jobs in the state of Oregon throughout the United States. Small businesses also get the vast majority of their small business loans through their community banks. And the question I really have is, we can talk about liquidity. Is this putting more liquidity out into the communities for credit unions to loan if they get this money? And the answer is, I don't care what formula is put on the table, the answer is absolutely no. There will not be any additional liquidity put out of any communities whatsoever. And be happy to talk specifically about that. If anybody believes that this bill is being established, or that one of the reasons I've heard the bill coming from the House was being established was to penalize the large banks because they're not lending in the communities, this bill has nothing to do with the large banks. It won't impact them they won't blink. You don't see them here. It's not an issue for them. This is a non-event. That has absolutely no effect on it whatsoever. This is about the community banks of the state. These are very difficult times, as we all know, in the economies. And the community banks in this state are really very similar and operate or trying to get through this downturn, this economy, just like the local hardware store is, just like the local cleaners are. These are difficult times. And they're trying to navigate the storm as well as they can. These community banks, however, are like the small businesses in the communities, are under an incredible amount of stress. Specifically here in the Pacific Northwest, incredible amount of stress. You know, one of the ways I actually look at this is the community banks, and I'm talking about the small banks, are they're under so much stress. I think they're on their knees. They're on their knees, and these type of bills, a bill like this, is basically taking a club and hitting them as hard as you can in the back of the head. So the question I think that has to be discussed, and it's unfortunate that it hasn't, we haven't had the time to do this, is these are tough times. Everybody's trying to navigate as the best they can through it. Nobody wants to do anything that's bad for the state. Everybody's trying to do the right thing for the state. But the unintended consequences of a bill like this, even though it might help the credit unions if they think that it will, great. The problem is, it hurts the community banks. Why in the world would we want to bring any bill against any industry to penalize it in this type of economy? For what reason? That makes absolutely no sense to any human, to any rational person at all. We've got to create jobs. We've got to do what's right for this state to get this state out of the hole that we're in. And this is not how we do it. I think that if the community banks of the state, which we're down to 31, 32 community banks, you can see how it has shrunk. But I think if the legislature of Oregon, if you don't want community banks anymore, if you just don't want them, why don't you just say so? Why don't we just raise our hand and say, you know what? We don't need you. You're not serving a purpose because we're condemned if we have bank in our name. You're a bad guy. But if you don't want them, don't put us through the waterboard torture program. Just tell us that you either want us to move out or close up so we can take the necessary action. Polarizing community banks in a time where we can help create jobs, we can help create small businesses, makes no sense whatsoever. Thank you very much for letting me give testimony.
Questions for Mr. Davis or Ms. Navarro?
Yes.
Yes. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Appreciate both of your testimony. Let me first just give an opening comment, and then I've got a handful of questions. Number one, I believe this bill is a political bill. I may be the only one that says that, but I believe it is. Number two, I believe very little will come out of the session regarding jobs and job creation. And line number three, if the credit unions and the banks wanted to fight about tax exempt status, it should have been handled in 1934, because this bill is not going to affect that.
Correct.
So I've got stacks of email here from bankers saying that they're not taxed, and that's really great, but that's I don't have the authority to do that. What I do have the authority to do is make sure the public institutions have a good fiduciary when they make an investment. And so along those lines, with my three caveats that I'm probably the only one that feels that specific about, but notwithstanding, with those three caveats, explain to me, you said it about liquidity, you made a comment about this will not make credit unions more liquid, this will not make you more liquid. Can you explain a little bit more what you're saying?
Sure, I'd be happy to. In a very simplistic way that I like to keep things, excuse me, Senator Atkinson and Chair, thank you for the opportunity. It's as simple as this. If you're doing is you're taking one liquid asset away from one institution, giving it to another, and that institution has to collateralize or pledge securities for those deposits. So if I'm a credit union and you want to deposit $1 million in my credit union, I understand by the rules of this law, this bill, the way it's laid out, is they've got to collateralize that $1 million, which means that liquid asset that they had as a security is no longer liquid. So it's a dollar for dollar. If, in other words, the $1 million that they had in the securities could have been sold and could have been loaned out immediately. So it's a zero-sum game no matter how you play it. There is no more liquidity. If you take $1 million away from my bank, that's $1 million of liquidity that goes away, but I also free up $1 million of collateral, which I now can convert to cash and make it, again, liquid. So there's no more liquidity. This isn't going to impact the small communities for small business loans. That's not going to happen.
Okay. Several follow-ups, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is that okay? Thank you. And just as I predicted, as you were nodding yes, there's other people nodding no. So this is
absolutely
very, it works very well.
Yeah.
I agree with you with your comments about this not affecting large banks. Quite honestly, we are a state, in my opinion, that has got zero capital market. None. In my life outside of this building, you can't raise capital in Oregon. I can't raise capital out of your members. I haven't tried to raise money out of credit unions, and I don't raise any venture capital here because Oregon has dried up, at least for the types of transactions I'm involved with. But given that, I'm very concerned as the fiduciary for the state and for this money on this bill that your members are unable to provide to my constituents lines of credit because of FDIC and cease and desist orders. And I don't believe necessarily that anybody here was trying to do any wrong dealing. I think they made some bad decisions, and you can't forecast the market.
Correct.
However, you're not born with bad credit. You've earned it somehow. And now my banks are being bailed out, and my companies are not getting lines of credit. So tell me that this is good practice, that we should still have money housed in your bank when my small businesses can't get access to lines of credit.
Mr. Chairman and yes. Senator Atkinson, good point. First thing is this. We could sit here, and let me also say to you, Senator Atkinson, I totally agree with you. This isn't about tax or no tax. Okay, that's another discussion that has to be some other time. This is about what's doing right for the state of Oregon today, in my opinion. We could sit here all day and talk about businesses, specific businesses, small businesses, big business, medium businesses, that for some reason, for one reason or another, could not get a line of credit, could not get a small business loan for whatever reason. Either they had bad credit or the bank was tied up and with a cease and desist and they couldn't make the loans. But we don't talk about the hundreds, the thousands of loans we make every single day. Every single day. Now, it's fair to say in this economy that is it harder to get credit from anywhere? Yes. It has to be because people's financial statements aren't probably as good as they used to be as they run through this process. Is loan demand down? Yes. People are retrenching. People don't want to, you know, we've heard talks in the national media about the U.S. deleveraging, and it's a good thing. As we continue to deleverage, I think as we come out of this, I think these companies are going to be much more healthier and they'll start generating more profits. But there is no question in my mind that, as I gave you an example of Umpqua Bank, of the $1.7 billion of loans that we have originated, and a vast majority of those, well, we loan only to small and medium-sized businesses. We're not we leave the big companies to the larger institutions. We don't go there. So the banks are making loans. Now, not every community bank is under a cease and desist order. Not true. Those that are under a cease and desist order, it does not say in their cease and desist orders they can't loan money out. They can loan money out. They might have some limitations, but I guarantee you their limitations are probably still much larger than what the credit unions can do. So so many times when a individual is turned down for a line of credit or a small business loan, it's natural to blame the financial institution for it. And sometimes maybe that's true, but there's a lot of times when the person just doesn't qualify no matter what.
Mr. Davis, I appreciate that, and I know we're talking semantics, but I can tell you right now in companies I work with and a board that I sit on mm-hmm. who has perfect credit and been upstanding members of their community that their lines of credit have been withdrawn that they've had for years
sure.
have been withdrawn. I have one who's Bank of Cascades client who has been there from the creation of the client or creation of the bank, worked with the bank, served probably on the board of the bank, however I won't say that yes or no, who's now having their company withdrawn because they can't get credit out of the bank and the bank has asked for their cash back. That's all fine. And I can give you line and line and line of clients of mine in my other life who I have had to go out of state to get capital for because I can't meet the underwriting standards that are placed on from the financial institution. So me, with my public hat on as a senator, now I have to say what is the best financial decision for these public funds. And I'm not so sure that the current status quo is working for the taxpayer. That's my concern.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Atkinson, I hear you loud and clear. But again, you're talking about the institution that is severely stressed. You're not talking about all of the institutions in this state that are getting their loans, getting their capital, if they qualify like everyone else.
I'll just make one comment. That's great in Portland. That's not great in Southern Oregon or Central Oregon.
Senator, there's more than one bank in your district, for goodness sake.
I realize
that person, if they get turned down from a bank in Bank of Cascades.
I'll bring you a company, you find me a loan.
Pardon me?
I'll bring you a company and you find me a loan.
I'd love to see it.
Okay.
Bring it to me.
Senator Atkinson, I'd love to just make a couple remarks along this line. First of all, I don't doubt anything you're saying, but I will say, A, you don't have to force banks to lend. That's what they're in the business of doing, and a bank cannot make any money if they can't make loans that are able to be repaid. So in the broad issue of are banks willing to lend, if they have the capacity to lend, they're absolutely willing to lend. But another point I think is relevant, and I spend hours and hours every week talking about credit availability and lending in various forums. But another point that's very interesting is going into, if you go back to the 1980s, 70% of credit in the United States was extended within the banking industry, the traditional banking industry, banks like our members. Going into this recession in 2007, it was 30%. And yet bank credit has grown over those three decades. The point being, there was an explosion of credit in recent years outside of traditional banking. And I think that's relevant because traditional banks aren't going to be able to make up for all the credit that dried up here in Oregon and across the country, but they are still lending. And finally, I'll just say that with regard to public deposits, I hope that the issue of lending and credit contraction and availability of credit doesn't become the driving factor in deciding whether credit unions should receive public funds, because as Ray said, and as is the case, this bill doesn't create any new liquidity in the marketplace for lending. It just shifts it from tax-paying entities to tax-exempt entities.
Senator?
Mr. Davis, thank you for your testimony and your candor and your passion for that, and also congratulations for running a very good institution, UMQA. It's excellent. I think one question to you, though. We've heard, you know, different arguments about different things. What this piece of legislation would do, it doesn't require anything of any institution, but so it would be, as whether you're a special district or any other kind of public body, you know, they can choose to go. I mean, they may not choose to go. They could go to Umpqua, or they could go to a credit union, or they could go to Wells Fargo. So, and of course, not only is the float that they may the bank may generate as these funds come in and out, that's a factor. The service that is provided, that public entity, is a factor. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that people compete on that make a difference as to how they feel comfortable about that. So, just give me your assessment of what's wrong in the marketplace of having just that option. I mean, you're going to want to compete for those funds and the services that you're providing versus someone else. And at the end of the day, some of the other differences may be very minor. The service may be the biggest one. It all depends. But what's the problem with having that option available to be competitive with those funds?
Senator Metzger, thank you for the question. Now, this gets back to, we're going to have to go back to 1934, Senator, so bear with me for just a second. If we were all treated the same, absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. If you ran a cleaner's, and I hate to use silly, well, these aren't silly, these are tough examples. If you are an owner of a cleaner's, and the guy across the street has a cleaner's, and yet his cleaning division, because of something that the state is doing, he gets his supplies, you know, pick a number, you know, 20% at a 20% less cost, that he can pass those savings on to his customers and clean your shirt for a lot less money than maybe I could in mine. Okay, that's not right. How would you like it? You wouldn't. Nobody would. I don't care what kind, forget banks. I don't care what kind of business you're in. You're not going to like somebody having a competitive advantage that's established by the government. It is what it is, but it's still, you're not going to like it. So I think if we were treated the same, I think that's more the merrier, absolutely. Mm-hmm. One of the problems here is that in the current situation, the real world, and we know taxes aren't going to change right now, but in the real world, or at least this one isn't, is the credit unions, because they have the tax advantage, can make it more difficult for the smaller community banks to retain those deposits. I don't care how good their service is. Service can be fantastic, but those districts have a responsibility to the public for getting the best return on those funds as they possibly can. And the credit unions certainly have an advantage, I think you will agree with me, on their ability to price those deposits up because they don't have the tax consequence of it. That's fair. So what you're doing is you're doing two things. One is the bank, the small bank in Prineville or wherever it may be, is either going to, number one, lose those deposits, potentially. This isn't a guarantee, as you said. You're right. But potentially could lose those deposits, which would hurt their profitability, which would put the rest of their deposits in this environment today, economy today, potentially at risk. Not good policy. Second thing is, if that small community bank says, no, we want to keep these deposits, there's nothing keeping that small community bank from saying, well, I've got to match that rate. In other words, I've got to move my cost of funds up. Again, impacting the bottom line of the small community bank. Again, impacting state revenues, impacting their ability to generate a profit and the safety of the deposits for their customers. So there's a huge fundamental problem.
Well, and I appreciate that, and I understand the point you're making on that. In fairness, that's one half of the ledger. You know, you talk about the differences in terms of regulation and state or federal, because on the other half of the ledger, your bank and others have the ability to raise capital. Credit unions don't. That's only through their deposits. They can't go out and sell shares or raise capital, outside capital, at the same manner that you could. Thank you.
Can I respond?
Yeah, please.
Senator, thank you again. Yeah, they could.
Not the same way.
Not under the framework they have right now.
Right.
But they have options, and they can make those changes, and they can raise all the capital they care to if they want to. Those are rules I play under. They can play under the same rules. I mean, just like the cleaner. He's got to raise capital.
Thanks. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we could have tickets to a WWF competition with these people. Hustina Squires, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hustina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents over 900 special service districts throughout the state who provide about 26 different types of services, including water, sewer, irrigation, fire, ports, parks, libraries, 911. So I'm here today to register our support for House Bill 3700. I think this is the third time that I've testified on this bill, and I'm hoping it will be the last. Appreciate your willingness to hear me at this late hour. I'd like to start by saying our local governments support all of our financial institutions, so I sort of feel as if I'm being thrown into this bank versus credit union debate. We don't see it as a debate. We see it as a choice, and a choice that we would like the opportunity to make at the local level. 61% of our special districts have budgets over $250,000 and would enjoy the opportunity to take advantage of this if this bill was passed. I think something that's important for you to understand from our perspective is that as public stewards of public funds, it is our fiduciary obligation to get the best interest rate that we can get on public dollars that are invested in any public depository. We have large special districts, for instance, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue serving 12 or so cities in Washington County, who absolutely use a bank. They'll probably continue to use a bank. We have smaller districts that will probably use, if this bill is passed, a combination of credit union and bank. So we don't really see this as anything more than a choice, and a choice that we'd appreciate the opportunity for you to give us to make. We'd like to support the bill.
I'd be
happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3700. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3704. Thank you very much. Would you like to go over the bill for us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3704A allows two or more beverage distributors or importers to establish distributor cooperative to collect container refunds from distributors or importers to refund dealers the amount paid for value of empty containers, pays refund value for beverage containers sold in state, and processed beverage containers in state. requires the cooperative service majority of dealers in state, permits dealer to use cooperative to redeem and process beverage containers of non-participating distributors or importers so long as dealer or cooperative provides accounting to non-participating distributor or importer. This measure comes to you with a House vote of 43-15-2. There is no revenue impact. You should have a fiscal statement on the A version in your packet.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go out of order on the call sheet just a moment, and in the fine tradition of the Oregon State Senate Marriage Counseling, I'm going to bring forward Mr. Joe Gilliam and Mr. Paul Romain.
Okay, and while they come forward, I'm going to request that Legislative Counsel come to the committee.
He's here.
Mm-hmm. Have we done the first? Any of the others?
It was too easy.
I'm going to sit next to him, not even apart. His hand goes to my knee, it's all over.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Gilliam, representing Northwest Grocery Association. Most of the retailers you know and love and shop at and all in, around the state. I guess I want to open with remarks that the deposits we're about to talk about have nothing to do with the bill prior to this one. I don't want to be associated right now with that fight. We're here to talk about how to implement Senate Bill 707 from the 2000 session that expanded the Oregon Bottle Bill. Just to give you a quick rundown of the stats of what we're talking about from that bill is there are approximately 3,000 retail locations that redeem bottles and cans in the state of Oregon. In 2010, those 3,000 locations will take in approximately 1.7 billion containers. That includes the water bottles that were expanded in 2007. 300 supermarkets do 70% of that volume in redemption. So about 1.1 billion of the containers go through 300, or a tenth of the locations. And that's really what this bill is centered on, are those locations. House Bill 3704 is necessary for us to implement Senate Bill 707. Two significant things came up in that piece of legislation. One was the addition of water and flavored water, which increased the volume about 40% across the system. The second piece, which is that is not the sexy piece that people hear about or talk about in the public, is it required retailers of over 5,000 square feet to redeem the type of beverage container of any type of beverage they sold. So if you sell water, you have to take back any brand, even if you sell it through your store. Same thing with for soda, same thing for beer. If you sell those types of beverages, you have to bring back any brand. And that changed the very nature of the bottle bill drastically. Since that time, we've gone through great lengths to accommodate this, and some really good things have happened in the process. The legislature wanted us to create a universal redemption system for the consumer, so they didn't have to worry about what brand was in their bag when they brought it back. They can just go one place and drop it off. What this bill does is complete that loop and allows for universal redemption at the back of our doors to all our distributors. In the process of moving forward with Senate Bill 707, if you can imagine, as those bottles and cans start coming in and they were belonging to different brand makers and people and different stores, you know, how does Fred Meyer go to Albertsons and get their cans redeemed, get their nickel back because they fronted to the consumer? How does Albertsons go to Safeway? Safeway go to Costco? Costco to Walmart? It just all of a sudden is crossfire everywhere. And what happened was, to accommodate the new law, is we created a statewide cooperative where five cooperatives of distributors. Many of my members are distributors in terms of their store brands or their private labels. They joined the co-op. They took five different cooperatives and blended those assets and put them all together. So all the nickels could be put into one pot and all the brands could be a central clearinghouse so this system could work. There's one final piece. 95% of the volume goes through this co-op and 5% does not. And this is where the problem comes for the retailer. We are supportive and we are committed. We have our money where our mouth is on making 707 work.
Okay.
But the problem is on the back dock. When we have distributors, and there are several, and you're going to hear from them, who have not joined the co-op. And we're not attempting to try to make them join the co-op.
No.
But their non-membership has caused a huge problem for us in the mechanical spot. For every one of those distributors who has a brand that is not part of the statewide co-op, we have to sort that out separately. We have to pull that aside and make that available for them to pick up. You've been to the reverse vending machines. You've seen them. They crush the can, or they break the glass, or they crush the plastic bottle. So you don't actually give them back their brand per se, but you have to give them back an allotment that matches up to the, how many of their brand cans are restored.
Yeah.
This may be from somebody I don't even do business with, but now I own these brands. So how do we do that? We have to pull those out and sort separate while everybody else is in a system where it's all going one place. Costs us thousands of dollars, slows us down, and takes up extra room in our back rooms that we shouldn't have to be dealing with. When the state has said we want a universal system from the retailer, we're asking for the same thing in the back room. If we didn't have a statewide co-op that worked, you can look on page 5 of my testimony, that picture depicts what our back rooms would look like without a co-op. We would have to have all those separate boxes for all those separate brands. It would be 1973 all over again, and the system would fall under its own weight. We're not here asking that you repeal any part of the 707. We're not asking you to go backwards on this thing. We're asking you to help us go forward with you and meet our mandate under this. House Bill 3704 does not require anyone to join the statewide co-op. What it says is if you choose not to be in the statewide co-op, and that statewide co-op services more than half the retail locations, then and you choose not to, the retailer is not put on the spot to separate and sort your brands. We can let that material go right through the system, and what it allows us to do is to present them with an electronic record, accounting of their brands, in order to get our deposits back. It's what we do today. It's the same method we do today, but the salvage value of the containers and the cost of hauling glass just goes through the system instead of being sorted out. Any non-member distributor who chooses not to join, which is fine, still keeps their unredeemed nickels. So those are still in their pocket. So if you take their brand and you put it in your curbside, or you put it in the burn pile, whatever you do with them, that nickel is still in the system and they keep it. We don't keep it. Retailer doesn't keep it. Cooperative doesn't keep it. We're not here trying to do something evil to these guys. They're good companies and they're good people. But the problem is you've given us a mandate to accomplish a goal, and we're striving to do that, but we have a glitch in the system. 3704 is needed today. Even if the non-member distributors joined today and said, we're in, the problem wouldn't go away, because what happens in the future, what happens if 6 more distributors want to pull out and do the same thing? What happens if a large big box retailer who is also a distributor pulls out and forces costs on his competitors by having them to separate and sort their brand on their docks? Then the cooperative starts to fail, and it starts coming apart, and 707 starts to come apart at the seams. And that is a huge, huge issue for us. What happens in the future if you want to expand the bottle bill and add sports drinks, add the tea drinks, add the energy drinks, and that distributor says, well, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to put the cost on you. It's not fair for the retailer to have to burden all those costs. We would like an incentive. We would like them to join. If they don't, that's okay, too, under this bill. It works better if everyone joins. That's why 95% of the volume is in the co-op. But this doesn't force them to join. It doesn't put a gun to their head. You can't have a cooperative that works that way. It'll fall apart. But it does clean up the system and say, keep doing what you're doing. You just can't clog up the back room at the retailers for your own purposes and your own financial gain. So we ask you today to really give us the last piece, the last tool for us to accomplish not only the 40% increase you gave us through our stores, but also the redemption center network that we're trying to set up around the state that everybody has, the bottle bill task force has recommended, we've committed to, we're making the financial commitment to do. And that is not a small commitment. That is a $20 million commitment a year once we get every redemption center up and running. So, you know, everybody has a cost in this thing. You're going to hear testimony about how it costs the small distributor. It costs everybody. The bottle bill doesn't, there's no fees in it. There's no money taken out of it. The consumer doesn't pay anything through their deposit. It costs every one of us. And these 300 stores, because of what's been going on without everyone joining in, costing them tens of thousands of dollars at every store in labor costs to do this. It's absolutely unfair to put that on a retailer.
Okay. Mr. Roman, and then we'll go to questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, and we're in favor of 3704. The reason that it was actually a little comical that the two of us come up together is because you usually see us fighting over various issues. And that's really what happened up until just fairly recently. The only thing we agreed upon for years was we didn't want the bottle bill expanded. And then we got to a point in 2007 where the bottle bill was going to be expanded. So what we did was try and figure out how it is that you could expand it to do the two things you really voiced to us you wanted to do. One was you wanted to expand containers and at least bring in water, if not other containers. The second one was, nothing biblical implied, but universal redemption, which was basically you could take something that's sold in Ontario and get your nickel back for it in Medford. That was very important. And whether it was sold, it was branded Fred Meyer, you could take it to a Safeway. You could take it to any place. That made it convenient for the consumer. But what it envisioned was, frankly, a statewide cooperative effort of all distributors. And most distributors, of all the things that are involved with this, most distributors and most manufacturers joined together to try and put together a statewide cooperative. But what you have out there are a few people who we call free riders. Basically, what happens in a free riding situation is they take advantages of the economies of what others have established. And that's really what's happening, because the co-op is the one who's building out the redemption center system. The co-op probably is the one who's going to operate redemption at the grocery stores that you will all maybe continue to use. The co-op is the thing that's essential to really make the bottle bill work. Because when you have, in effect, universal redemption, where you could take it back any place, it necessitates some entity being able to go any place to pick it up. So what does 3704 do? That's the most important thing, because you have before you, I think, probably an antitrust opinion by legislative counsel. Unfortunately, they were subjected to trying to write a very complicated opinion within a very short period of time, and I'm not sure they got it right. So let me explain to you exactly what this bill really does. First of all, it says two or more distributors or importers may establish a cooperative. In other words, anybody can establish a cooperative if you're in a beverage distribution business. The only requirement is that you service a majority of dealers, and dealers are grocers. It doesn't have to include a majority of distributors. It could be two importers, two manufacturers, two distributors, but they have to service a majority of the people in the state, because otherwise it's useless. You can't set up something that's just going to work your area. That's the old bottle bill. That's what distributors individually did very, very well. But when you changed it, you necessitated a different thing. So, first of all, you're not forcing anybody into any kind of setup. You're saying any two people can do it. The second thing it does is it says the grocer has increased cost if you have to sort in the back room. We all know that. That's the most expensive thing for the grocer, is the sorting in the back room. And what a cooperative does is eliminate the sort. So what you're saying in this bill is if the grocer still has to sort because somebody hasn't joined a co-op, then what you're going to allow them to do, the grocer, is in effect keep the scrap. That will pay them for it. Now, the grocer can do whatever they want with the scrap. They could just say, fine, we'll keep it and we'll just give it to whoever comes in, the co-op. Or they could sell it to the co-op. They could sell it to a third party. They could build a pyramid outside their business with it. They can do whatever they want. It's theirs. It's theirs to deal with, to compensate them for the cost of having to, in effect, sort things out. Now, what what you have here, there's no compulsion to join. In fact, the first part of Section 2 that allows two or more distributors to establish a co-op is really not even necessary, because in five different areas of the states, distributors already had co-ops under the old bottle bill. They were for their own little region, because they didn't have to go to Timbuktu or wherever to pick up bottles and cans. Container recovery is one that you're pretty familiar with out of Portland, but that was done without any kind of statutory authorization to form a co-op. And frankly, the same antitrust arguments were raised by other distributors who didn't want to join and grocers who didn't want to deal with them and things like that, and nothing ever came of it 20 years ago, and the cooperative was incredibly successful and frankly was the model for how we went forward with this. At best, what you could say about any kind of state law that compels activity that you don't want to do is it's what's called a unilateral restraint. But you have unilateral restraints all over the place. A speeding law is a unilateral restraint. You tell me, I'm a delivery person for pizza, and I can't go more than 35 miles per hour, yet, I could be more efficient if I could go 50 miles per hour, but you've put a restraint on me. It doesn't require any state supervision whatsoever. And if there is any kind of restraint in this, like the authorization to the grocer that they can keep the scrap, that is a unilateral action. There's no necessity whatsoever for any kind of state supervision. Now, I went through this stuff ad nauseum for the last few years, representing the Washington State distributors in what's called the Costco litigation. Costco sued the state of Washington over a number of alcohol beverage control restraints, if you would. And the case went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I was the lead counsel for the distributors. We teamed with the state of Washington, and we won a unanimous opinion at the Ninth Circuit. This stuff is not antitrust. It's simply somebody trying to raise flags to trying to get you to not pass needed legislation. What we have here is a piece of legislation that's very, very good. Coupled with the part that allows for the distributor cooperative and gives the grocer the opportunity to get a little bit of payment if somebody's not in the grocer cooperative, is the requirement of reporting. And that was added because we committed to the state that we would report numbers. And what it says is that if you are part of the cooperative has all the numbers, how much your sales are, what the redemption rate is, and they will report to the cooperative. If you're not part of the cooperative, obviously the cooperative cannot report for you, so you, the individual distributor, have to report to the state those numbers. So for the first time since 1972, the implementation of the bottle bill, you will have exact numbers on what is redeemed and what is not. So you will have that information. What does this do for you? With a cooperative, the cross-border problem goes away, and that's your biggest impediment to raising the deposit amount. Because if you raise the deposit amount to 10 cents, you get more redemption. We know that. People will bring things back. But what stops it is a distributor who's on the border who now will be over-redeeming huge amounts of product because stuff will be coming across. What you do is, in effect, socialize the cost. You socialize the cost of the cross-border. So it frees you up for that kind of thing. It also frees you up for expansion to other products if you so desire, because the system is in place. And finally, it gives you the redemption system that you've always wanted in place. We urge you to pass this bill. It's a good bill. It's a continuation of the bottle bill. It's a continuation of our commitment to those who asked us to help craft the system. We urge its passage. Thank you.
Okay. What it's the intent of the chair to do at this time is we'll be calling up some of the other witnesses, but I do know that there are going to be a lot of questions around the legal opinion that Senator Morse asked. So what I'm going to do is call up a few of the other people, then I would ask
Mr. Romaine, if you would come back up.
Thank you.
And Mr. Gardner, if you would come up, and Legislative Council would come up, because it's not that I like debates, but I would think that that might be the most appropriate way to address some of the issues that might come up in that discussion.
Mr. Chair, you were not here when Senator Atkinson asked the two of us to come up, but it was more for marriage counseling purposes than anything else.
Yes, he made some comments on your complimentary attire.
Mr. Chair, could I just add one last thing to my testimony?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the very back of my testimony are letters from retailers who represent 80% of the volume in the areas that have non-member distributors. There was testimony in the House that retailers, this wasn't a problem for retailers, and retailers liked the service they were getting. These retailers are in support of this bill and have stated directly that they are not pleased with the service and the problems they're having in the back room. And I wanted to bring those to your attention, because those are the actual people dealing with it on the ground every day. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you. Now I will bring Mr. Featherstone up. And Ms. They're going to be a little bit different.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Featherstone, why don't you go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Barry Featherstone. I am principal of Graybill Distributing in Pendleton, Oregon. I am also a director for the OBRC, the Oregon Beverage Recycle Co-op. I almost believe I'm testifying at the wrong or for the wrong bill, because I am also a founder of Centerpoint Community Bank in Hood River, the state's most recent community bank. We were chartered 2.5 years ago. We'll get back to the bottle bill. Graybill Distributing is a 55-year-old Oregon-based business. It currently supports 5 families, all of the children of Jay Graybill, who founded the business in 1955. We cover 5 states in eastern Oregon: Morrow, Umatilla, Union, Baker, and Wallowa counties. It's just about 30,000 square miles with 132,000 people in it. So our problems are kind of, they grow exponentially, because I have more windshield time driving to and from store to store than most distributors do in the state of Oregon. The issue that is in front of you today comes down to money. That's what it really comes down to. Today, the distributors make a considerable amount of money in managing the bottle bill on behalf of the state. So you're going to hear me testify, and you're going to hear other distributors testify about what's good and bad and different. And really, all of that is irrelevant, because it comes down to, it's our own personal issues. It's Graybill Distributing's personal problem. It's Pepsi's personal problem. It's PD's problem. It's all these distributors. And it's our issue to manage our business around what the state legislates. What's important for this committee to really think about is what it means to the state. And there's really 4 things that come into consideration. If the state wants to expand the bottle bill to incorporate energy drinks, sports drinks, mayonnaise, bottles, whatever it goes in the future, without a statewide cooperative, there's no way to collect and manage those deposits. There's no way to reconcile a Sam's Club product versus a Safeway Select versus an Albertsons versus a Miller Coors versus Anheuser-Busch, Coca-Cola, or any of the other suppliers. And there's over 200 manufacturers who put deposit items into this state today. So expansion requires a cooperative, and or it at least requires people to participate in that cooperative. If you want to increase the deposit from a nickel to a dime, and I believe that there are environmentalists out there that are going to be pushing for that in 2011, the cooperative becomes more and more important. If you want to create redemption centers, and it's my understanding that that is the direction under which the state wants to go at this point in time, is to have redemption centers to get some of this stuff out of the back rooms of the grocers and all the other retailers, you need to have a facility under which to, one, fund, to manage those redemption centers. The most important thing to me as a person about the bottle bill today is it doesn't really cost me any money as a citizen. I buy products just like everybody else. Go to the store, I pick up brand X. Won't tell you what I drink, but I bring it back. I pay my $1.20, I take it back, I get my $1.20 back. So as a citizen, the fact that it doesn't really cost me anything is very important. As a business person who manages those nickels, it's important that we drive costs out of the system and not costs into it, because I'm telling you, as a beer distributor, if it costs me more money, I raise the price of my product. So ultimately, it will cost the citizens of this state more if we don't come together. The last thing that is important in this bill is that for the very first time in 38 years, the state will know whether or not the distributors are lying to them, because we're going to tell you what the redemption rates are. We're going to show you what we sell, what comes back, and what the difference is. For 38 years, people have been coming up here in front of you telling you whatever the hell they wanted, because you had no way to know whether it was right or not. So one of the most important things in this bill is the state's ability to see under the covers for the very first time what goes on and how much money really is in play. Those five things are what the decision needs to be based upon. All the other stuff that I'm going to tell you here in the next few minutes, it's emotion. I mean, it's me spouting off about something that I want versus some other guy who doesn't want it. But those five things are what are important to the citizens of this state. If we want to expand the bill, want to increase deposits, want to have redemption centers out there, we need everybody participating. This bill doesn't say you have to join the co-op. This bill doesn't say that. So the nine holdouts, and there are nine holdouts across the state, if they don't want to join, they don't have to. In fact, as a board member of the OBRC, in the case of some of them, I'd prefer if they didn't. My job would be a whole hell of a lot easier. So I'm not advocating that every one of them join. Okay? What's important in this is that they don't walk away without contributing to what's important to the state. And that's all that this bill is about. If they're going to profit, then they need to contribute. And all we're saying is pay your fair share towards what's important to the state, the expansion of the bill, and redemption centers. That's all it's about. If you think about this, what is impacted is their salvage, not the unredeems. So if they collect $100,000 a year and they only pay out $80,000, they keep that $20,000. What this deals with is the garbage, the recycled material that sits in the back room of your retailers today. Those materials are picked up, separated, and sold. The profit that comes from that sale, and those profits vary from year to year. Price of aluminum goes up and down. Price of plastic up and down. Price of glass never goes up, always down on that one. And then the cardboard, up and down like a yo-yo. Okay? What this bill says is that amount varies. So that's something that on some years you won't even notice it. On other years it may be significant based upon the price of those commodities. This only impacts what is sold at retailers. It doesn't impact what's sold in bars and restaurants, only things sold at retail. And then on that piece, it's only what is sold and electronically counted. What that amounts to is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of between 55 and 60% of their total salvage. And what we're saying is that salvage will go back into the co-op to fund the things that are important to the citizens of this state. Okay? It'll cover out-of-state redemptions that illegally come into the state. It'll cover the redemption centers that need to be built on an ongoing basis. So we're not saying you pay everything. All we're saying is pay your fair share to where we want to take this. If you don't want to belong to the organization, so be it. That's fine. But you can't ride for free on what 95% of the community wants. You need to pay a portion, and only a portion, of your profits to the good of the state. Now, you're going to hear other distributors come up after me. They're going to talk about warehouses and investments and employees. And they're going to say stuff like, geez, I built this warehouse to hold all this stuff. Geez, I have this equipment I invested in. Jeez, I have all these employees, and we pay living wages. Well, you know what? The OBRC pays living wages. And in my zone, Zone 5, Eastern Oregon, where there's not a whole lot of jobs, there wasn't a single job that was lost because the people that worked there before, they're still there. Blue Goose Recycling, still there, still employs three guys. The OBRC uses them. The one guy that I had hired to go around and pick up product, he doesn't work for me, but there's another employee who works for the OBRC who drives around and picks up all the product. You're going to hear stories about companies that, oh, they were put out of business. That was Burns Oil. Burns Oil is still in business. Burns Oil had a sideline where he drove around and picked up recycling materials. He opted out of the OBRC for business reasons. When Hodgin Distributing failed to join, his volume fell by 35%. That's right. Someone who didn't join the co-op forced another business to drop out. So the holdouts are actually causing more problems than they say that they're trying to correct or to prevent future loss of jobs. We've offered another large distributor that's a holdout the opportunity under which to do the processing. Haven't heard back. And that's what this is all about. If you're making money in the six digits, okay, and a distributor that sells more than 500,000 cases a year, which all but, well, six of the nine holdouts, so six of the nine holdouts are earning six-digit revenues off of this thing, okay? If I came to you and I said, well, I want you to give up 20 to 25% of that, you go, what the hell with you? Why would I want to do that? What this is about is people asking everyone to contribute and some people not wanting to contribute and holding out. And they know, because they've been holding out for 2 years, that the longer they hold out, the more money that they pocket. So if you don't pass this bill today, I guarantee it's going to be up in 2011. And what's happened is the people that are riding on the tailcoats of others will have profited 20 to 25% for one more year. Where will the state be a year from then? No further along. In fact, you know what? If you don't pass the bill, I can guarantee you that the 95% of the people who are participating are going to be in here arguing with you not to expand the bottle bill, not to put in redemption centers, not to raise the deposits, because you're screwing the people that are participating. Your job, right, is to set good policy. The best policy is to say, hey, you know what, we don't care if you participate, but you got to contribute. And that's what this bill is all about. And I can tell you, because I've called seven of the nine holdouts, they're in delay tactic mode. They're all in Senator Farioli's office, to be 3 weeks ago this coming Tuesday. Went around the table. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Okay, well, 3 weeks later, not a one of them's called me. I've called seven of them. It's pretty disappointing, their responses. Well, we'll wait and see. God, you know, I was in there yesterday, talked to Senator Farioli. The bill, Senate Bill 992, went up there. And you know what? My good friend canceled that for me, so I got another year to worry about this. You know what? I don't want to pay for everybody else for another year. I joined this because I knew it was the right thing to do. I didn't join it because I thought I'd save myself money. I joined it fully knowing it would cost me money. All I'm asking you to do is take these other guys that are riding along and ask them to contribute. And in exchange for that, we're more than willing to share with the state exactly what comes through. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. And thank you for traveling so far to be here.
Thank you.
Okay. Now Mr. Markey and Mr.
Pastega.
There you go. My pronunciation isn't very good and my eyesight is worse.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey, representing Hodgin Distributing in Eastern Oregon, Pendleton area. Mr. Pastega is with me today, and he's a Pepsi-Cola dealer in Corvallis and Tillamook, where I grew up, and down in Medford. I am not an expert in this in this area. I do have some experience with people trying to deal with each other when they don't trust each other. And I can tell you that this has gone on long enough that you hear the emotion from people like the previous witness and the folks in Eastern Oregon who have been presented with ultimatums have refused to go forward in joining this co-op. The real question here is, can these people come to terms? And what I suggested to the folks that have not joined the co-op that we're working with was that that they should agree to enter into some talks with the other folks here, perhaps with a professional mediator, and see if they couldn't come to some agreement. And in the House, the chair of the committee and both the Republican leader and the Democratic leader thought that that was a good idea, but the other side said no. So here we are, and they passed their bill in the House, and you're going to consider it today, and it may pass. But I think that's unfortunate. I think that when you have a situation like this, and there is a lot of misinformation on both sides, a lot of these problems could be resolved, and people could work together in meaningful ways. And I would just suggest to you that there may be more than one business model that works in this area. And Mr. Romain said this doesn't require anybody to join the co-op, and I would say that it doesn't say that in words, certainly, but it does say that two or more distributors can form a co-op, providing that the co-op services a majority of dealers across the state. And and the bill would become effective upon passage. There is presently one co-op that serves dealers across the state, and so there could never be another one. I mean, there will be one, and that will create a monopoly for this one co-op. And so I handed out advice from your legal counsel down the hall, legislative counsel, and I would simply urge you to read that and look at what they believe to be some of the problems that might be created by this legislation for you in the state of Oregon from an antitrust standpoint. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Pastega, who came up here on very short notice, and you can see he's dressed in honor of the Olympics today.
I thought he was a player.
My player. Chairman and committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and speak to you about this situation. First of all, I want to clarify one thing. We are not free riders, and we're honest business people. Our family was given the Ethics Award by the Portland Rotary Club and the Willamette University this last year. My dad still works in the business 93 years. He's 93 years old, and we've been in business in the state of Oregon since 1948, longer than anybody that has spoken so far. But anyway, we service a Benton, Lynn, Tillamook, Jackson, Josephine, and part of Polk County in the state of Oregon. And we've done so successfully, and we have been a very ethical company, or we probably wouldn't be in business today. Part of it, I think we could skip through a lot of things, because Barry touched on some real issues here, and I think the piece that was forgotten in the earlier comments were that, first of all, we sat down with Senator Farioli a few weeks ago, and he made a suggestion about mediation through the Portland State University. The whole group of individuals that are, and most of them aren't here today to testify because of such short notice, and that's why I'm in the attire I'm in at this point in time, is because I didn't have time to go home and change my clothes, or I would have put a sports jacket on. I figured, what the heck. Anyway, Senator Farioli suggested that we mediate over this situation. I don't think we're not opposed to joining OBRC, to tell you the truth. And we were given a phone call, seven phone calls. One of those individuals was me. It was a phone call, would you be interested in participating in OBRC if you were the recycling center? You bet. I would be interested. But you know what? First, I want to see some economics. I'm not going to make a decision over the phone. I would like to see something in writing that tells me what this is as far as what it's going to cost my company or generate revenue for my company, in participating in this. Right now, the grocer is not using this way of dealing with the products that come in the stores. They're dealing with this situation. Every consumer puts it through a machine that reads the UPC code. There's bags that go in the back room, and the only difference is now there's an OBRC truck that picks up those containers that are due for their members, and we back up and pick up our containers for ourselves. That's the only difference. And yes, the comments previously, we built 10,000 square foot building to deal with recycling. We put in all kinds of equipment. We chose to participate in the recycling business, and most of the members of OBRC didn't participate because they didn't want to back up their trucks to the back of the stores, pick up the deposit items, take them back to their facilities, and process them. We chose to do that when the bottle bill was implemented. Even before the bottle bill was implemented, we had glass containers that had a nickel and 10 cents on them. We picked up those containers and processed those. So I think that the consumers are being taken care of. As right now, there's absolutely nothing happening that would affect the deposits or the recycling thing. And if there was recycling centers, we would be willing to participate. I think that this is basically a power play. We have big billion-dollar companies that are legislating laws that impact the economics of their business, OBRC. And what they're trying to do is bring us all into it to participate in it and relieve some of that cost, and they're using the bottle bill as an excuse and redemption centers. And I think those things will be taken care of. I think if they would sit down and mediate in good faith, I've made a presentation to their board of directors that basically said, here's options that we'd be willing to participate. And they basically said, it's one way, and we will not negotiate. Now, I think it's almost a David and Goliath. We're the Davids and they're the Goliaths, and we're at a standstill, but we're willing to mediate without using legislation to their advantage. They have the ability to legislate a lot more powerfully than the small independent businessmen that are located right in this state. We're all independent, located, but the majority of the size of the corporations that they're involved with in OBRC are corporations outside of the state of Oregon. So all we're asking for is the ability to mediate. There should be a bill written that forces them to mediate with us, not forcing us to participate in their organization. And again, this legislation would cost our organization 15 jobs, and that's what was communicated to you earlier. But I think if these family-owned businesses were given the ability to sit down and have mediation, we would solve this problem, and we'd get it taken care of, and everybody would participate on the same level. And I think that's the end of my comments. If you had any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you. Actually, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Pastego, how long has your company been in operation?
Since 1948. I was two.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Gardner, will you come forward? Now, the intent is, I believe Mr. Gardner is here to represent Walmart. The intent is, after his initial testimony, that I'm going to bring up Ledge Council and also Mr. Romaine to Ledge Council is going to give a very objective overview of their memo. Then I'm going to have you and Mr. Romaine debate.
Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for that opportunity. Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Gardner with the law and lobbying firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Walmart, which perhaps from a superficial point of view is in the somewhat incongruous position as the largest retailer in the United States, indeed in the world, the quintessential billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar corporation, siding with the small homegrown distributors. And that's not because we are antagonistic in any way, shape, or form to OBRC. We are members of OBRC in our capacity as retailers or dealers, as well as importers and distributors. We qualify on all three grounds. And in fact, we are one of three retailers that is listed on an application that has been filed with the OLCC for the very first redemption center that will be located in the Wood Village area. And we've expressed our strong interest in participating in future redemption centers across the state. That's not our motive is not anti-OBRC in any way, shape, or form. I just want to make that very clear. What our concern is really that we really don't see the necessity or the wisdom for this bill. First, it's not necessary to create OBRC. OBRC already exists. So if you look at lines 6 through 15 of the bill, those are unnecessary. That entity exists now. It is a creature of contract. Let me repeat that, a creature of contract, of private agreement, and we think that is what it ought to remain. The real effect of this bill, the provisions from line 16 on, is to essentially take what is primarily a private agreement and alter one crucial term of it. And to be very candid, in most instances, that would probably be in Walmart's economic favor. But the precedent of doing that by statute, of reaching into that contractual arrangement, and by legislative fiat changing it, that really concerns us. That's not a good precedent. And it's going to have, I think, some unforeseen collateral effects. One of them is going to be a level of dissatisfaction, which you've heard expressed today, on the part of distributors who operate in, particularly in rural areas of the state, where a lot of our stores are located. And that concerns us greatly, that you have that level of dissension and dissatisfaction as a result of essentially a legislative fiat. The second concern, frankly, is that we do see exposure for litigation. That has the potential, a disruptive potential for OBRC, a cost potential for OBRC, and potentially some negative effects for the program, which so far has been implemented by the private sector on a private sector basis without government intervention and interference. And we think that's the way that we ought to proceed going forward. There is room for negotiations, as you've heard today. This ought to be a matter of private contract, private agreement, not government fiat.
Questions for Mr. Gardner? Thank you very much, Mr. Gardner. I'll bring you back up here in just a few moments. Mr. Meyer, would you come forward? I guess it's Mr. Meyer and Mr. Tukey.
Yes, it is.
Would you both please identify yourselves for the record? And I think there are going to be some questions about the memorandum, but can you give a brief overview of the memorandum?
Chair Devlin, committee, Doug Tukey, Office of Legislative Counsel, Mark Meyer, Office of Legislative Counsel. The opinion that was written raises a potential issue in terms of House Bill 3704. The issue that it raises is in terms of monopoly and monopoly power, should there be one distributorship. The opinion notes that nothing in the bill as it's written limits a distributor co-op to one. There potentially could be many. The opinion also notes that testimony at the earlier hearings indicated that there was one now operating in Oregon. The opinion does not address the mediation potential solution raised by Senator Farioli, but focuses on the state action immunity doctrine as a solution to potential issues raised with antitrust issues. So the opinion gives an overview of federal antitrust law and focuses on the bill and what the potential issues would be, looking at potential market and market power. One of the issues it talks about is in terms of competitiveness and the potential issue of the effect of the competitiveness of the distributors who don't participate in the co-op, i.e., whether or not them not being able to get their beverage containers back could potentially affect that. In terms of the potential solution under the state action immunity doctrine, that was first enunciated by the Supreme Court in 1943 in the Parker case, further clarified in 1980 in the Midcal case. And basically what that does is it sets forth a framework basically where the state oversees the activity. So there's a clear enunciation of state policy in the bill, and then to allow the anti-competitive behavior, and then basically oversight by the state. So, for example, in this case, it might be the OLCC that would do that. So the memo identifies that as a potential solution in addition to the other one that Senator Farioli mentioned. So that's a brief overview. I don't know if Mark had anything he wanted to add.
I just have, I just have two things to add, Chair Devlin. The first thing is that I think that we made clear in the opinion that we can't tell by looking at the face of this bill whether or not an antitrust challenge would succeed, because that's a factual issue that needs to be determined by looking at all the evidence, including the relevant product market, geographic market, and then the actual attaining of monopoly power or price fixing. The time constraints we had to write the opinion, it didn't allow us to do any of that factual inquiry. Industry insiders might be a little bit better at explaining those relevant concepts. What we try to focus on in the opinion is descriptions of the cooperative that speak to those things that you normally see with monopoly power. So in this particular bill, there's a description of a cooperative that must service a majority of dealers in the state. It's a description of a very large recycling business that has greater access to the raw materials required for operation than perhaps some of the smaller distributors. Also, I think that the Section 2.3, we talk a little bit about how this method of accounting, it allows all the recycle value to be accounted for, but the raw materials in question, the actual materials that these people are concerned with for their businesses, which is the recycling business, that isn't going to be accounted for. That speaks a little bit to leveling out, disrupting competitiveness in the marketplace. Would those two things be enough for anti-litigation suit to succeed? I can't say, and I think that we said that in our opinion. I think that what you need to take from the opinion is basically that, yeah, there are some descriptions of this particular entity that are problematic. We can't solve those through the state action exemption doctrine by including amendments to the bill. However, that said, we can't predict how this would come out in the real world. Industry insiders, other people who are more familiar with the cooperative as it exists right now, they'd be able to speak better to that than us. The one other thing that I wanted to say is, other than Section 2.3, I agree with most of the testimony here that said that this cooperative, as it exists, exists independently of this bill. The bill isn't necessary to create the cooperative, of course. Section 2.3 is the only thing that really does anything substantively with the bottle bill in providing for accounting of the refund value of the cans. If antitrust litigation were brought against this cooperative, it would be just as likely to succeed without the existence of the bill as it would be with the existence of the bill. That's my opinion, and I think that I probably didn't point that out in the opinion that I wrote here, and probably I should have. So if there are potential problems with this cooperative as it exists, I think that they exist now, and antitrust litigation could succeed. There's only one other thing that the bill would do. It would make it exempt from state antitrust law underneath the permitted activity use enunciated in ORS 646-740. So you couldn't bring, if we pass this bill, you couldn't bring an antitrust suit in state court against the cooperative. You'd have to go to federal court. So that is the two things I have to add to what Doug Tookie said. Are there any questions?
What questions? Senator Ferriola?
No, Mr. Chairman, the question that occurred to me was the one that was raised earlier in testimony about the implication of a cooperative that must have the capacity to serve the majority of dealers in the state. Would, by, at least it was observed that by implication that would strongly suggest there just be one to, whose aggregate service would be the majority of the distributors.
Right, and that's one of those things, again, where the bill describes it in a form that makes it sound like, yeah, this could be indicia of monopoly power or of a cooperative as monopoly power. We would need more factual evidence of that monopoly power to say definitively whether it exists. But I agree that obviously it indicates that, and with the testimony that occurred on February 1st, there's only one cooperative that currently exists that qualifies underneath the description in the bill. So,
Chair Devlin's, Senator Ferriero, I think the argument could be made that they could overlap. So, in other words, maybe one dealer could conceivably service for plastic, the other for the aluminum. So there's an argument in terms of overlapping service, maybe, the way it's written.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Mr. Gardner and Mr. Romaine, would you care to come forward? I'm not actually referring to this as a debate, but just giving you both the opportunity to comment.
Mr. Chair, Jim Gardner, I'll just be very brief. I want to focus on one of the comments that was just made, which is antitrust litigation is equally likely whether or not this bill passes or not. I, from a practical point of view, and you always have to evaluate litigation risk from, you know, from a practical point of view based on what people say they intend to do, I don't believe that's a correct statement. I think that the, if passage of this bill would increase materially litigation risk. Now, those may be people blowing smoke, may never materialize, but based on what I have heard, that risk would increase materially were you to pass the bill. The second thing I'm not going to get into are the various antitrust claims, which I can assure you would not be restricted to monopolization, that a creative plaintiff's antitrust lawyer would come up with if this case were filed, if a Sherman Act case were filed in federal court. What I do want to focus on is the state action immunity discussion in the opinion, which I think is absolutely spot on. And just a little bit of background there. Once upon a time, long ago and far away, I had the opportunity to serve as a law clerk for Potter Stewart on the United States Supreme Court, and one of my assignments was to assist him in drafting the dissenting opinion in a case called Cantor versus Detroit Edison. And that case was the beginning of the evolution of the modern doctrine, the modern Parker versus Brown doctrine of state action immunity. For better or worse, Justice Stewart was on the losing side of that case. He
wrote the dissenting opinion, which urged a more expansive interpretation of state action immunity than the majority of the justices chose to implement. The majority decision in Cantor versus Detroit Edison became the sort of opening bell in the march toward MidCal, which is the decision that's discussed in the LC opinion. And MidCal has two essential elements which must be present in order for there to be state action immunity. The first is a clearly articulated state policy to displace competition. And the second is active state supervision of the putatively anti-competitive conduct. The classic instance of that is PUC regulation of a regulated utility, which sets rates, allocates territories. Things that would, if two utilities were to agree to do that, absent state oversight, would be per se illegal. That's not going to be present here. So whatever risk this bill may create, the one thing I think I can assure you is that LC is correct in saying there will not be a plausible, credible argument of state action immunity.
Okay. Mr. Romain.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Paul Romain, and since we're throwing out credentials, I had the opportunity, the honor of being the law clerk for the Chief Judge of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals when I graduated law school, the Honorable Richard Chambers. And I've been around antitrust law for a long time. I was actually the vice chair of the treasurer of the antitrust section of the Oregon State Bar years and years and years ago when I was a young person. But let me just go over a couple of things. First of all, legislative counsel, in their opinion, basically says that we don't know whether this causes an antitrust problem. That's really what they're saying. They're saying it could, it may not. I want to read you two paragraphs from it, and they're on page 3, sort of the middle. It says, that said, House Bill 3704 does not speak to the other indicia of monopoly power. It does not appear to create entry barriers to the market for recycled goods. It does not require the cooperative to accrue a special profit. It does not speak to how the price of recycled materials will respond to potential changes in supply and demand. And finally, it does not address the potential of price discrimination. One final note. The industry in question here, production of recycled materials from returned beverage containers, is an industry that has been created by statute. You created it. That was not in the opinion. I added that. If not for the existence of the bottle bill, there would be no financial incentive for consumers of beverages to return their containers to dealers. Thus, the very production of the product in question, recycled beverage containers, is a product of state law. With that in mind, a court may evaluate the existence of monopoly power in this industry in a manner different from the way it would evaluate the existence of monopoly power in other industries. Now, let's look at what actually occurs in the business right now. As legislative counsel said, we don't need this bill to create a co-op. The co-op is already created. What this bill says is you can have more than one cooperative, and what's important to note is you just have to service the majority of grocers. That's what a dealer is. It doesn't have to include the majority of distributors. It can include two or more distributors. So you could have a cooperative that decides to just do plastic, or you could have a cooperative that decides to do glass, or one that does aluminum, or frankly one that just does certain product lines. That's acceptable under the bill. Second of all, there is no benefit that accrues to the cooperative by the existence of this bill. Nothing. The benefit goes to the grocer. The grocer's back room is what benefits, because the grocer now owns the scrap. Yes, I'm supporting the grocer. No smirks. The marriage counsel, he works. The grocer is the one who can determine what to do with that scrap material, and they can sell it because it's their back room that's clogged up. The cooperative may get the material, it may have to buy the material, or the grocer can do whatever they want with the material. The bottom line is that This bill does nothing for the cooperative. It does everything for the grocer that doesn't have to sort. Finally, again, to go back to the state action issue, the state action doctrine, basically, in the Mid-Cal case, which actually dealt with Gallo wine from the early 80s, basically it was when the state gives control to private enterprise to, in effect, set prices to fix things like that, then you need active supervision. Because, in effect, what you're doing is setting up a state-run system, and the state can't just let private people do it. We ran into that with what's called price posting here in the state. We used to have to post our price of alcohol, hold it for 30 days or whatever the period of time was, and we couldn't sell it to anybody else at any kind of different price. And, frankly, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that that is an antitrust violation. What you have here is nothing like that. You have, at best, again, a unilateral restraint which doesn't involve any kind of state action, and there is no requirement whatsoever in a unilateral restraint, if there is one even in the bill, to have the state actively supervise. So there is no issue here. It's smokescreen. We set up container recovery in Portland, again, around 1989, 1990, and the exact same issues were raised by the people who didn't want to join, and they had their own parochial reasons for not wanting to join. And if somebody doesn't want to join, they don't have to join. But if you don't join, then the grocer should not be punished by having to do the sort, and the state basically should be able to get the numbers from you the same way the state would get the numbers from the cooperative. Thank you.
Mr. Gardner.
Yes, very briefly. And again, it is at least superficially somewhat ironic that I'm here for Walmart, largest grocer, largest retailer in the world, really. Kind of speaking up on the side of the little distributors. I want to just highlight, but the reason is, for us, it really is an issue of principle, and it's an important principle. Mr. Romain said, and I think quite accurately, this bill is not needed to create the co-op. You don't need this bill to create the co-op. The bill, however, and not a privately negotiated contract, would dictate one particular element of the relationship between the retailers and the wholesalers, and that has to do with who owns the scrap. And you'd have to ask yourself, why is the state properly in the business of rewriting or writing an element of a contract when the great glory of the recycling system that we've had in Oregon is it been a creature of the private sector in large part. Paul's excellent members who have worked so diligently to create this reverse market that we have today. And that's where we think that you ought to leave the matter. You should let the private market, the private sector work. Don't put the heavy hand of the government into this arrangement.
30 seconds, Mr.
Okay.
One minute. I'll give
it's
you
Friday.
Equal time.
It is Friday. I realize that.
Good close.
The problem is that, again, Mr. Gardner is right. This bill, all it does is say who owns the scrap. That's really all it's doing. It's just dictating who owns the scrap. You would have an antitrust problem here if you basically said the co-op got the scrap. That'd be an antitrust problem. You're not dictating that. It's the grocer. Grocer doesn't have to sort. Period. End of question. Grocer, you get to keep it. You can do whatever you want with it. You can sell it to whomever you want for the highest price. That's all you're doing with this bill. Let me just give you a scenario where somebody might want to not participate in a co-op. Somebody could end up in a situation where they take delivery of product out of state, ship it into the state, sell it. If they don't have to report to any kind of entity out there, then you don't know how many nickels are collected or out there. You don't know how many containers came into the state. We need everybody participating in the co-op or some form of co-op where there is some kind of at least minimal accountability to make this system work. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Thank you all.
I'm going to close that public hearing, but before I do close that public hearing, I would ask a courtesy to the chair if the proponents that are in the room would designate one representative who the chair could contact in the short term, and if the opponents in the room could designate one person the chair could contact in the short term, it would be very beneficial.
Mr. Chair, on the antitrust issue or on the bill as a whole?
Well, if I give you okay, Mr. Gilliam and Mr. Romaine, okay. Are those okay? On the opposition? Okay. Chair understands. Okay. That public hearing is closed.
Thank you.
Senator Farioli coming back.
You told him
they just take it outside.
I don't know if that would
be. Mr. Chair,
it's kind of fair.
I think we've got something here. I think we should marry the credit union bill to this bill. We're both talking about public deposits, and we're talking about opting in. I mean, that's. I think we could put these two bills together and come up with, you know, Paper Reduction Act.
Oh, we're
going to
miss
Matt.
Okay.
As long as it passes. Yeah, that's right.
We're okay with that.
Is the gentleman that has to sit through all of this in the second row, is he our state police?
Yes, he is.
Yes, you are.
Yes, and he wants to go home, too. It's Friday.
What are we doing right now?
We're going into work sessions. Okay. Not on this bill. I just closed the public hearing. I'm going to go to the bottom bill first. Not the bottle bill, but the bottom bill. SB 1064. I'm going to open a public, or no, I'm going to open a work session on SB 1064. Do I have a motion to send to the floor with the due pass recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1064 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion?
I'll be an objection, Mr. Chair.
Yes. And could the committee assistant call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Yeah.
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Devlin?
Aye. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, vote explanation.
Yes.
I have not spent, I have not spent enough time with that bill yet. It was on my to-do list today, and I don't want to vote for a bill I'm not fully on board with. So I'll read it quickly.
Okay. Understand, Senator Atkinson. And Senator Farioli, did you want to add anything? Or
Mr. Chairman, it would probably confound the issue more than necessary. But I will serve notice of intent to file a minority report, but I will reserve the right to withdraw that notice at some point in the very near future.
Point of clarification, Mr. Chair. Given that there's only 7 minutes to five, what happens to our rule?
I think you would have 1 hour after the, and Legislative Council will have to
remain 1 hour.
As of right now?
As of when we adjourn.
Mr. Chairman, we have 1 hour to notify Ledge Council of the subject matter.
The subject matter,
right.
Not the entire.
That doesn't mean they have to stand around and
right.
Write.
No, it does not.
No. 1 hour from adjournment.
Thank you for that clarification.
I just want to remain on Legislative Council's good side.
Okay.
Excellent.
So that bill will be going to the floor with potentially minority report, potentially without. Senator Pruszynski will carry. I'll close that work session. Now, on 3700, the intent of the chair is to only move the -4 amendments at this time. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3700 solely for the purpose of moving the -4 amendments. Do I have such a motion?
Mr. Chairman, the author of the -4 is here, but I'll move the -4 amendments to help move the process forward.
Okay. Senator Farioli has moved the -4 amendments. Is there any discussion of the -4 amendments? Is there any objection to the -4 amendments? Hearing none, the motion passes. I'm going to close that work session. I would ask that the Mr. Martinez is here, but if they could also notify Ms. Leavitt so that people are aware that we may have had a work session, but we did not pass out the bill at this time. Rumors in this building are rampant, so I just want to make sure that people get the right indication of what has happened. With that, our work for today, it has concluded.
And what's our expectation tomorrow for rules?
We are going to be posted at 1 o'clock. However, the intent of the chair is we will be on the floor at 9:30. We will not meet before 1 o'clock unless I have to. Given the number of bills on the floor tomorrow, I doubt very seriously we're going to be over before noon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Not to interrupt your brilliant train of thought.
No, it's not that brilliant, but...
Would it be possible to post the Rules Committee at, like, 11, given that if an act of God and all the planets are in line and other miraculous things were to occur?
For instance, nobody shows up?
Regardless of denial of quorum or anything else, that we could get to our work very quickly.
The Senate President hopefully is not listening to this committee here. Yes, I can post, but I would like to post, let's say, I will listen to the committee's concerns. I will post at 11:30, which is really optimistic. But my intent is to give the members that have been on the floor, which hopefully is all of us, a half an hour between the time on the floor and the time the committee starts, so that they can get themselves gathered, get their bills, maybe get a little bit of refreshment, and then we'll come to the committee. So I'll post for 11:30.
I love this.
The lobby needs to be aware that it might be 11:30, but if we don't get it done on the floor to 1:30 in the afternoon, it will be at 2.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the agenda will be posted to the effect of subject to the conclusion of floor session, and even to the extent that we could put a comment that says the committee will convene half an hour after floor session if it ends after 11:30, so everybody is kind of understands the parameters around when we'll start if floor session runs long.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that concern.
Anything else? With that, we are adjourned for today.